I want to try and discuss one of the ideas behind Sukkah. So they called the title of this evening's discussion in the shadow of faith. But the truth is that title has a very serious source. The Zohar, which as you know is the source of Jewish mystical wisdom, or at least that's the main repository of the wisdom that we have from the mystical world, the Zohar says that the Sukkah is what's called Tzelet Demehen Musa, which means it is the shade of faith. That's what it says. We want to try and understand, what does that mean? What is the shadow of faith? What sounds poetic, but what does it mean? Tonight I think we'll try and make it a bit shorter because there's a function afterwards. But perhaps over the next few weeks what we can do, what I'd like to do in Yisrael Hashem, is try and work out the whole Jewish idea of Emunah, the Jewish concept of faith, because it's a very difficult concept. It's difficult because the essence of it is the opposite of what the non-Jewish world thinks. And of course, as you're all aware from these discussions, that most of us think like they do. We don't think like Jews. We think in the non-Jewish way that the Western culture has taught us to think. So we translate the idea of faith, of Emunah, let's say, we translate in English as being faith or belief. And the problem with that is, of course, that faith and belief mean things that are blind. And the very essence of those words in English means that you believe something that you can't ever know. And the Jewish attitude to that is that that's silly. Because to believe something that you can't know, you'll never have a proof for, so that's a silly thing to do. From many points of view, first of all, the person next to you will believe something different. Why are you better than him? He believes the opposite of what you believe. So who's right? And the next person believes the third thing. You follow? There's no point of reference. If there's no fixed point where you can actually know something, where you can actually prove something in some way or another, so then to believe something in a blind way doesn't make sense at all. Come up with whatever you want to believe in. That's not what the spiritual world is all about. The Jewish translation of Emunah, of faith, means knowledge. We don't have a concept called faith. There's no such thing as faith or belief. Well, let's try and work that out in more detail. But let's tonight just lay down an introduction to this idea. First of all, what does the Sukkah mean? Now, that's a beautiful mitzvah outside your house. You sit in an airy garden setting. A beautiful idea. But in the Kirkus HaMetesh, in the Pnimius, in the internal dimension of what the human soul is, what does it represent? Some of the deepest secrets of the mystical world are hidden in this area that's called Sukkah. The Sukkah has very interesting features that no other mitzvah has. First of all, it has a unique paradox. The paradox is that the Sukkah is flimsy. Now that's the whole idea. The Sukkah has to be so flimsy that the rain comes through. That's the qualifying characteristic of a Sukkah. The walls can be solid, but the roof must be such that you could see the stars. Preferably you should be able to see the stars, but the rain doesn't have to be able to come through. It means it's a very poor protection. And yet the whole mitzvah of Sukkah is always discussed as being protection. But the whole concept of Sukkah is that you're protected there. You're not protected in your house. When you move out into Sukkah, you move into a special spiritual dimension of protection. How is it that the flimsiness of the Sukkah, the fact that it doesn't protect you against elements like your house does, how come that when you convert into that mode, so then you get spiritual protection? What does that mean? And the mystics say that the protection lasts all year. What you draw down into your neshama from sitting in the Sukkah, or at least from experiencing what the Sukkah is, you draw down into the neshama the power that protects you through the year. Now what is this idea? Let's try and work it out in a little bit. What does it have to do with Emunah? What kind of protection is it? How do you live inside the shadow of Emunah? Faith, the English word is meaningless, but that thing called Emunah, how do you live inside it, and how does the Sukkah build that? That's what we want to try and understand. So the first thing is this. One of the unique things about Sukkah is that you put your whole body into it. There's no other mitzvah like that. There's no other mitzvah like that. There's no other mitzvah that involves the whole body. I know you're going to jump up and ask me what about mikveh. It's not a problem. Mikveh, many say, is only a hefshe mitzvah. It's a thing you do to take off tumah, and it's not an inevitable mitzvah. So, I mean, if you happen to be coming, I'm not going to go into the halakhic ramifications of what mikveh is. But and a skirt in the Sukkah. You put your whole body into the Sukkah. You're completely enclosed in it. It's a remarkable thing. One idea that you can take out of that is as follows. You know, we've discussed many times together that in the mystical system, any time you do a mitzvah with a certain part of the body, so you hold that organ in the spiritual world. If you do a mitzvah with a hand, then what happens is in the spiritual world, you hold that organ or that limb which corresponds to the human hand. We've discussed many times that the spiritual world is built in the same way as the human. Or the human is built, rather, in the same way as the spiritual world is. The same parts, the same organs, the same parts of the body. Except there they exist in abstraction, in their real, essential form. Here they exist in a tangible, concrete form just to teach us about the reality. But they correspond exactly. Each of the 613 parts of the spiritual world corresponds to a mitzvah that you do with a part of your being. When you do the mitzvah with that part of your essence, or your body, or your mind, whichever it is, usually it's the body, most mitzvahs are done with the body, then you build that part of the spiritual world. The remarkable thing is there's only one mitzvah that you do with the whole body. It's a remarkable thing. You put your whole body into it. Everything, right? Now, that mitzvah corresponds, that must correspond to something very special in the spiritual world. And what it corresponds to is a certain dimension of this thing called emunah, which is a profession. Yes. Try and look further and understand more. Sukkah also means, that you can see. The word sachar Hebrew means to see, but it means to see through. You know, it says that Sarah, the great the woman who founded the Jewish people, Sarah Imani, her name, one of her names was Sachar. Sachar says, right? Because it says in Chazal, called Sachin Beyotia. There are people here, people, that make you uncomfortable in this case. Whatever it is. I call Sachin Beyotia. That means everybody could see through her beauty. But the word in Hebrew doesn't mean that looking at this woman of beauty, you perceive this, you saw something special. What it means is by looking through this woman, you saw the spiritual reality. That means she was so beautiful that you could see right through her. What does that mean? It means she had raised, listen carefully, she raised herself to such a level of perfection that she was such a spiritual being that when you looked at her, you saw the reality. When you looked at this woman, you saw a sense. You of course realize that the world we live in is exactly the opposite. What they want you to see is only skin deep. They hate you to see deeper than that. That's the way the world works now. People don't want you to see deeper than that. Right? People would be terribly embarrassed if you could see deeper than skin deep. In fact, I don't even want you to see the skin. That's just so much layers on top of that now. Because they can't even at that level. That's what's up. But what Sarah was, she was so transparent of beauty. A remarkable thing in Hebrew, the concept of beauty always goes with transparency. It's a remarkable thing, being able to see through. Ugliness in Hebrew. The Hebrew word for ugliness means it's kiur. It's the same letters as achur, which means opaque. Isn't that remarkable? The word for ugliness in Hebrew is made up of the same elements as the word for meaning you can't see pure things. Because Hebrew is a spiritual language. It's not a convention like in English. Ugly means ugly, got a big nose. It doesn't mean that. It means that there's a spiritual depth to the thing. Which means that if you can see through the thing, it's beautiful, because it doesn't obstruct any of the light. But when a thing's ugly, what it is in spiritual terms, you can't see the reality. Sukkah means that. Sachar, the root of the word sukkah, means to be able to see through. That's what emunah is. That means when you can see through to the source, instead of seeing, when you sit in your house, the problem is, the stronger your house is, the bigger obstacle it is to emunah. The more security systems you have in your house, the more security systems and the more the physical structure is strong, the less emunah you have. Because you rely more and more on the physical structure that you build around you, and you lose sight of the spiritual reality. The truth is that it doesn't matter how strong a house is, it's no protection. Now you've got to be very insensitive not to see that. You can live in a tremendous fortress, but one tiny micro that's waiting inside of you can wreak just as much havoc. You with me? And you can protect yourself only to a certain, there's a limit to what you can, but you lose sight of that. If you think if you build up, you know, there's a thing in Mitzvah that says a thick wallet is a wall between you and Hashem. But when you have a lot of material substance, so you think it's fine for yourself, but it's a terrible, terrible mistake. We think, my Rebbe once said that he was getting on a plane. Once he was boarding an aircraft, and as he walked up the stairs, he suddenly thought to himself, he looked at that, you know, he walked past an enormous jet engine as he walked up the stairs. And he said to himself, what am I doing? What is that thing stuff? What is that thing stuff for? And he said to himself, what is that thing stuff? Well, what's the difference? In other words, that's for you. That is, now Sukkah, when you move into a dimension that you're unprotected and you understand, you see accurately that the protection actually isn't in the physical reality, that enables you. It's by seeing through the Sukkah, it's by seeing through the thinness of it. It's by living in a dimension where you're not protected by the normal physical mechanisms, where you're subject to the elements, then you feel much more how fragile you are, and you raise yourself to a level of emunah. That's what you should do. Now you see that Sukkah always is an experience that comes after spiritual danger. That means when you go through a spiritual ordeal, you know, let's see the first message we can take out of this. When you go through a spiritual ordeal, if you win, if you cope with the ordeal correctly and you go as you should, the next step in spiritual terms always is to enter a state of protection where you consolidate and you ensure what you've got. If you don't protect it, then it's in great danger of collapsing. At the moment of greatest danger is after you've won. Because that's when the Yasuo is the strongest. When you've done it and you've achieved and you've reached the new level, you're at your most fragile. But people are sensitive can understand it. And therefore, that's when you have to take steps to enter a state of protection. You have to maintain that level with spiritual protection. One of the examples, if you look in Torah, you'll see the most remarkable series of events where there was an intense spiritual battle, and the next step was always entering that state of protection of a sukkah. Give you an example. It says that Yaakov Avinu, let's go back to the beginning. Yaakov, the father of the Jewish people, he had a tremendous battle with Esau, with the people, right? The non-Jewish, the concept of the anti-Semitic, the powers that are set up in the world to destroy what a Jew represents. He met Esau in a cosmic, right, meeting, and his life was in danger. He thought he was on the verge of being wiped out. He prepared himself for it intensely. He prepared for war. He davened, he sent gifts, he did everything he could have. He met his brother. In that critical moment when he could have killed him, brother could have killed him, he didn't. He didn't kill him. He survived the ordeal. Then Esau said, now that we're friends and brothers, let's walk together. That was the last thing Yaakov needed. The last thing he needed was to be together with a man like that. So he made an excuse. He said to him, well, we'll meet one day. I have to walk slowly. I've got children. I've got animals. You with your army. You move fast on horseback. You go ahead to your place and we'll meet there one day. He was serious about it. We will meet there one day. Mount Seir is the place where Esau lived. It means the heart of Western culture will meet there one day. When their reality is revealed, we'll meet. But not till then. That's what Yaakov meant. But when he achieved that victory and he split himself off from Esau and he remained safe and intact, where did he go? It says, Vayisa Yaakov to Kosa. He went from there to a place called Sukkot. You think it's accidental that he chose to go to a place that happened to be called a Sukkot? Yeah, in simple shop terms for a 6-year-old, it means he went from there to a place that was called a Sukkot. But it doesn't mean that. It means he moved into that dimension. The remarkable thing that Rashi says, and it says in Chumash, that when Yaakov went there, what did he do? It says he built sukkahs for his animals in the Mikmehu, he built sukkahs in the Mikmehu, he built sukkahs for his animals, he buys and he built a house for himself. But it's very strange. First of all, do you really care what he did for his animals? He built pens, he built sukkahs for his animals. And secondly, he took it first. The Torah says he first built sukkahs for his animals, a remarkable thing, and then he built a house for himself. But the idea is that the Torah always means, when it discusses animals, it means the lower side of the human self. It means the extension of the human into the physical dimension. We're not interested in what Yaakov did with his cows and sheep. It's irrelevant in Torah. But we're not interested. That's not what forms the world. It does in a certain dimension. But we're much more interested in what he did with the animal side of himself, the lower side. And the Tosfos is one of the great mystical commentaries which translates mystical ideas into understandable terms. Says that what it means is that Yaakov Avinu took the things that were subject to the physical forces and he protected them in a sukkah. That's a fantastic idea. For himself, he lived in a house. He didn't need a sukkah. But why? Says this. Because the purity of Yaakov, the essence of who he is, the essence of a Jew, is always here. It says, Neshama Shana Sato Bi Toherahi. The essential point of what I am as a Jew, that always stays here. But the fire that's subject to dominion, to the authority of the secular world, that's always in danger. And Yaakov's animals came from where? Where did he get rich from? Where did all his animals, his livestock come from? From Laban. Remember, he lived in Laban's house for many years, and he acquired wealth from him. Those animals were once owned by a man who had power in the physical world. They were under the dominion, in the domain, of a person powerful in the physical reality. They were always subject to that danger. It's a very, very deep idea that has to be discussed in much more detail. But briefly, so what he did was he took that side of himself which is subject to again being captured by the forces of evil, the forces of physicality, and he built a sukkah for them. But the purity of where he was, he was able to stay in a place that didn't need that protection. It's a remarkable thing. It means you need protection for that side of yourself that's subject to falling into error and being attracted after physicality of that other. But your inner purity doesn't need protection. It's a remarkable thing. You know where you see this idea in the sukkah very beautifully is the fact that, I don't know if you're aware, but the 7 days of Sukkot, you know, we have 8 days. You know, outside of Israel it's a little different, but the classical structure, there's 7 days, then there's an 8th day called Shmini Atzeret. That's the 8th day. What are these 7 and 8? What does it mean? Anyone who's been here a few times will know that 7 always represents the non-Jewish secular world. Always. The 8 is always a transcendent level. 7 always represents the physical reality. Always. Right, that's why the 7 days in the week. The 8 is always where you move into transcendence. That's why the Brit Mila is on the 8th day, because you're taking the body and you're making it more than human. That's why Hanukkah is 8 days, because Hanukkah represents miracles, which transcends the 8. Right? Always the 8 is that which is outside of the system. The 7 days of the Sukkah, you know what they're for? They're for the non-Jewish world. Then we sit in the sukkah for 7 days. You know what it built? It built their world. It's a remarkable thing. You know, we offer 70 sacrifices on sukkah. We don't do it now. We don't have to buy the mikkah. But the idea of sukkah is the offering of 70 different korbanah sacrifices. Why? Because they're 70 nations of the world. And they draw their sustenance from what we do in the sukkah. It's a remarkable thing. But the eighth day, that's atalal. The eighth day, right, it says in Midrash that Hashem says, let them all go home. It's a big party, invites the whole world. The king invites his whole kingdom. He has many days of feasting. After the 7 days of feasting, he says to all the guests, you can all leave. And he keeps his close family around him for a private meeting for the last day where he can really relate to them closely. That's what he says. That's what the Midrash says. That Hashem takes the nation and he says to them, you come into the sukkah, the mitzvah that they are relevant to that mitzvah. You draw your sustenance from this 7 days, build the physical reality. We'll do it for you, we'll do it with you. Then you leave. The eighth day, we stay alone with him, Shmini Atzeret. And that's why the eighth day we don't sit in the sukkah. Even though it's tagged on to the end of the Yom Tov Sukkot, but we don't need the protection when we're not subject to those forces that are the outside forces, we don't need that protection anymore. And that's how we move into the year. We start by taking the lower self, we build 7 days of the lower reality, we protect them in the sukkah, by Emunah, we can discuss that more. Then we transcend into the eighth level where we can move out of the protection of sukkah and we move into the year like that. So that's why it says that what you build on sukkah, that's your year. That's the year. Rosh Hashanah is the conception of the year. That's when the genes are laid down, they form. But they still have to go through the pregnancy. That's the 10 days, the 9 days that lead up to Yom Kippur, the 9 months of pregnancy, where all the 9 elements of creation get formed. The 10th day is Yom Kippur. That's the day when the baby is put together completely and is born. And that's when everything has to be cleansed and perfect. If it doesn't come out clean and right, then it will never be right. Then it's born. But if you don't move from there into a sukkah, which builds Emunah, which introduces you into contentment for the year, then you'll have nothing for the rest of the year. It'll crash after Yom Kippur, the most dangerous time when you come down after Yom Kippur. Here's some more examples. It says that when the Jews went through the Red Sea, what does it say? What's the next prophet? A tremendous ordeal. They came to the Red Sea, they were about to be drowned. Egyptians on one side, wild animals on another side, the desert side. What happened? Suddenly a miraculous thing occurred. They went through that spiritual experience. They came to the other side, and what does it say? Vayisu miramseh sukkot. They went from Ramses to Sukkot. You think it's another accident that they just happened to happen on the same place? Doesn't it? It means that after that spiritual battle, they went to place. The examples are endless. It says that in the next world, what's the experience of the next world? We sit in a sukkah. It says in the next world, you sit in a sukkah shall live yourself. A sukkah made out of the skin of this mystical fish called the leviathan. I'm not going to go into what that means now, but you sit in that sukkah. What's the sukkah going to do in the next world? This world's the ordeal. When you pass through the transition from this to that, you go through that frightening ordeal of transition, and you get jazzed at that time. So the next experience after that cleansing thing, always protection of sukkah. See, this idea runs through Jewish thinking over and over and over again. So it's worth understanding what it is you get out of sukkah to understand how to build this special reality. And let's try and focus on the idea of Emunah and try and see, just an introduction, we'll try again over the next few weeks maybe to work it out in detail, just the basis of Jewish faith, that's the first mitzvah in the Torah, to know that I can exist, to know it, not to believe it. What is this Jewish knowledge? We'll have to work it out in detail. But let's just try and lay down the groundwork for what this thing is called Emunah. The first thing to know is that having this thing called Emunah, again, not faith, but having this inner knowledge can do remarkable things in the world. The Gemara says that a person who has this level correctly can change the physical world. If a person, you see in English it's prostituted into the expression that if you believe enough you can make it happen. It doesn't mean what it sounds like in English, but it happens to be true. If you have enough in mind, it doesn't mean if you believe enough. It means if you have enough, if you have enough of this power of doubt, this inner source of power is powerful enough, the world shapes itself according to that belief. It has to be very strong. That's it. Somebody once came to Rabbi Joel to lunch and I said to him, a man once came to him and he said, do you mean to tell me, this actually happened. A man came to Rabbi Joel and he said to him, do you mean to tell me that if I believe that this lottery ticket will win, he had a lottery ticket in his head for the Russian lottery, hundreds of thousands, millions of rubles. Do you believe that if I believe that this lottery ticket will win strongly enough, you mean to say it will actually win? And he's also saying, definitely, there's no question. But are you serious? You mean to tell me that if I believe that this ticket, if I really, intensely, totally believe that this ticket's going to win, there's no possibility that it won't? And he also saying, definitely, it's an open Gemara, there's no question about it. So the man said, okay, I believe it, there's no question about it. I definitely believe that this ticket's going to win, okay, I'm totally sure about it. So he's also saying, how much is that ticket worth? What's the price? He said, 50,000 rubles. So we told him, I'll tell you what, since that ticket's going to win, there's no question about it, you and I both agree, I'll buy it from you right now for 49,000 rubles. And I said, sure, and another ticket. And so I said, you know what it's worth? He said, two copies. Because if you believe that this ticket is going to win, what are you being selling it at a discount? What are you selling it at 49 now? That, you know why you're selling it at 49, because you'd rather have 49 in the hand than the possibility that it will, the possibility is not good enough. Emunah's got to be tested. Emunah's got to be tested. That's why you can't play around with it. You can't play games with Emunah. It's got to be absolute and total Emunah. See, what we have to try and work out is that Emunah really means loyalty. Emunah really means loyalty. It doesn't mean belief. Ne'eman, the Hebrew root ne'eman, doesn't mean that you believe anything. It means that you stay steadfast and loyal to something. That's what it means. And loyalty always means absolute. Let's try and develop this idea and see what it means. First of all, let me share with you a remarkable story about how powerful Emunah can be. What it can do to you. I heard this from, this is a joke, okay? This is a joke. But it's a joke of a great man. I heard this from a black student, the Sefer Dayan of the Edacharim in Yishalayim. And the Yishalmi Jews, I think five or six or seven generations of Yishalmi, a long black coat. He told the following joke once. I had lunch with him and he told the following story. He said that this illustrates the power of Emunah. Many things like this have happened in other churches around. Tell you too many stories, but I'll tell you this one. There was once a young man who lived in Kenya. He lived in Yeshiva. He had his family to support. And he sat and learned Torah. There came a time when his father-in-law, who supported him learning Torah, came on hard times and couldn't support him anymore learning Torah. His father-in-law said to him, I tell you what, you've got to get a job. You've got to leave the Yeshiva, you've got to go out to start earning a living and support your family, I can't support you anymore. So the young man wasn't trying for anything. He went out to the world to try and find a job, and he tried and he couldn't find it. And he walked around for days and he tried this and that and menial labor and he couldn't find anything. Finally, when he was desperate and they were really about to starve, he found a job. What was the job? He went to a big hotel in the area where he lived, and there he approached the manager of the hotel for a job. The manager said to him, there's one job that I have that I'm prepared to give you. It's not easy, but it pays well. What's the job? Takes him out and he shows him an enormous arena. That thousands of people can sit around that arena. Says to him, what I do to entertain my guests at this resort is the following thing. I have a live battle between a lion and a tiger. And in this cage at this end of the arena, I have a lion. At that cage at that end of the arena, I have a tiger. Ferocious animals which I starve for days. When the crowd comes in to see, I open the gate, and these two animals have a fight to the death. They tear each other to pieces, and the crowd goes wild. That's a live lion, a live tiger, but that's... The interesting thing is that my lion's died. But I have his skin. But what I want you to do, it's not hard. All you've got to do is dress in this skin of this lion. And I'll put you in the cage, and the tiger will be by the side. And, you know, it tastes very well, this job. When you finish, I'll, you know, pay you and support you. So the young man thought, you know, that this wasn't a very good deal, but he was starving. His family was starving. He was on the point of death anyway. But you know what, I'll try. I'll try. I'll have a munna, I'll dive into Hashem. I'll try. So on the day, the point of day, he arrives at this place, he gets dressed in the lion's skin. He sits in the cage, and the manager tells him, this is what's going to happen. When I lift the gates of the cage, I'm going to shout out one. When I say one, you must put one paw forward. And he'll do the same, the tiger's going to come towards you. When I say two, you must put... And when I say ten, you'll meet in the middle of the arena. When I say the word ten, you go at each other, and you'll be paid very well. So he sits there in this lion skin, trembling and shaking, all drenched, and says, I don't know, he sees a ferocious fight. From this distance you can see the eyes, red, glowing eyes. He's saying to him like anything. Then, suddenly, when the crowd, the hush of the crowd, the gates go up and he hears one, put one forward. Two. When he gets to nine, he's standing in the middle of the arena, staring into the deep eyes of this enormous creature, and it's almost over. And as he hears the word ten, he shouts out, Shema Yisrael! And the tiger shouts, Hashem Elokeinu! It's actually a very deep story. Think about it, it's a very deep story. I heard from somebody that, in case you think this kind of thing doesn't happen, in case you think this isn't real in life, I heard from somebody that in the Philippines, in the Falklands War, you know, a few years ago, the war between Britain and Argentina and the Falklands, there was a Jewish-British soldier who had to kill an Argentinian. You know, there was mainly hand-to-hand fighting over there. You know, it was basically fighting in trenches on the ground, on the island. There was a Jewish boy in the British Army who came, he had to storm an Argentinian position, and he came upon an Argentinian soldier, and he had to shoot him. And as he was about to shoot him, before he could pick up his weapon, the Argentinian soldier shot Schmeichel. And he had his luck, he didn't have two Jews in that situation. Remarkable what a piece of emunah can do in terms of saving you. Now, let's look deeper at this idea of emunah. Let's just try and fill out one side of the picture. That's one basis that's essential here. And that is this. The first thing to know is this, that the secular translation has to be thrown out. Okay, that's going to just be an obstacle. Okay, faith and belief is out. The word, if you look in Torah, emunah, that always means faithfulness. It doesn't mean faith. And there's many proofs to it. If you look in Sumach, for example, it says that Moshe then had to hold his hands up. You remember there was a battle with Amalek, and that had his hands up. He had to hold his hands up. Aaron and Hur stood by him and helped him hold up his hands. And it says, V'hayu yodov emunah ad bo ha-shamah. His hands were emunah until the sun went down. It doesn't mean his hands were faith. It doesn't mean his hands were belief. It means they were faithful, they were steadfast. It means they stayed there. That's the Jewish concept of emunah. The Jewish concept of emunah means that you don't go believing anything. You know the thing. That's what we'll have to work out in more detail, how you get that knowledge. That's the last time's work. So that's what we strive for, definite, absolute knowledge. The work of emunah is staying with that knowledge, being faithful to that knowledge. You know that Hashem exists and that this is what you have to do in life. The work of emunah is, are you going to live up to that? Are you going to stay faithful to that knowledge? That's the work. That's the work in Kachat HaNefesh. That's where the work has to be put in. Achieving the knowledge is one thing. That's one area. That also takes work. That also takes a lifetime. That has to be discussed in detail. But also the person gets an inkling of the knowledge. Yeah? Just gets a faint hint of knowledge that he feels a certainty in one small dimension. Are you going to live up to that? Or are you going to let it go and pretend that it doesn't exist and live the way you want? That's the test of emunah's faithfulness, is loyalty. That's the basis of Jewish faith. Now, the reason it's difficult for us, first of all, I mistranslated the concept so we don't even have this idea that it's a thing called loyalty. But furthermore, the reason that it's difficult is because we live in a world where nobody has this anymore. Nobody has this concept called birth anymore. This generation doesn't have it at all. We're not used to this concept of meaning what you say about sticking to it to the death. Right? That's an essential thing to know. You know that even in a secular world, a secular non-Jewish world, 150 years ago, maybe even 100 years ago, the concept of loyalty, that means of faithfulness, of integrity, of sticking by your guns, of staying with what you said you do, of living up to your obligations, not tirelessly, without a single break ever, the world accepted that that was more important than life. The secular world accepted that that was more important than life itself. Think to yourself. An officer and gentleman in the British Army, in Britain, in the Prussian Army, in the German Army, in the Russian Army, an officer and gentleman in any of these places, if he ever broke his word, he went out and shot himself. Reckon it? Life just couldn't be looked after. He was ever shown up to have been a liar, or a cheat, or a fraud, in even the smallest way. If he broke faith with himself, or with his regiment, right, or with anything that he was supposed to give, is that correct? Life wasn't worth living. He couldn't face life. It was better off not to be alive. That was a value that the world held. But today, nobody needs it in the first place. Today, when somebody makes a commitment, in the first place, they don't need it. Marriage. Look at marriage today. Marriage is a loyalty. Marriage, of course, in the mystical sense, is where you learn loyalty. That's what it means. The essence of marriage is loyalty. It means that there was a time, our parents, our grandparents came to this country. Divorce was a very unusual thing. Very unusual. Even in marriages that weren't happy at all. But there was a commitment, there was a loyalty. You said that you were going to stay with the rest of your life. But today, what happened to that loyalty? A few months ago, you said that you were going to stay with the chickens for no matter what. What happened to that? You said that. You committed yourself. Where did that go? Today, people aren't even ashamed about it anymore. What concept of loyalty at all? The concept of loyalty, the Jewish concept, is that not only you stick by, but there can't be an instant break. If you think about it, you see that, look at a love relationship between two people, and ask yourself the question, does it work like other things in the world, that it works on averages, or does it work in absolute? Give you an example. Let's say you say to your wife, let's say your husband says to you, listen, we've been together for the last 25 years, right? Right. There's some woman that I'm interested in out there. So I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll spend a weekend with her, just 2 or 3 days, and then we'll pick up again where we left off. Now, that's not bad on average. What's 2 or 3 days out of, 25 years? On average, you're doing very well, right? It's not the right word, right? It's just not the right word. I mean, a man might think like that, but women who are creatures who have loyalty as an innate part of their nature, as it says in the mystical sources, what's wrong with it? Because the concept of neumonic, of loyalty, means unflinching, unwavering loyalty forever. There's no such thing as an ethic. It doesn't work that way. In Kashrut, you have to do it from everything. You know, if a little bit of milk falls into a meat soup, so on average, if the meat outweighs the milk, you can eat it. But loyalty doesn't work that way. Loyalty and love don't work that way. They have to be absolute. The Jewish people's love for Hashem, it's only in the last 150 years that it's broken down. Until then, the Jewish people en masse, with almost no exceptions through history, underwent torture. The youngest children underwent unbelievable torture. Rather than pretend to accept anybody else's religion. Why? That's what loyalty means. That's what emuna means. Emuna means sticking by it even when it looks like you're wrong. You know what it says in all the deeper writings? That when the Mashiach comes, the final ordeal will be proof that we're wrong. That will be the final ordeal. It's easy to stick by it when things are going well. But there will be proof then that we're wrong and they're right. And then we'll see who's safe. But when it looks, that's what emuna means. Emuna means when you stay with a friend and you don't drop a friend, even though all the evidence looks like they've left you. That's what emuna means. When you hear stories that this friend is doing this and they're doing that and this is what's happened, they've been unfaithful to you in this way and that way, emuna means you never ever drop a friend. Ever. That's what emuna means. You aren't worth being alive if you don't have one. Let's look at this from Torah sources. You'll see the most remarkable things. If you look in Torah sources, you'll see many amazing illustrations that the quality of emuna is worth more than life. But a more remarkable thing you'll see is that examples of emuna always come from the physical world, not from the human world. Right? So to say. The Gemara says there was a certain chicken that had a secret. That's understanding mystical Gemara, I'm not going to go into it. But there was a certain chicken that had a secret, certain thing that they needed, I think, for building their Beit HaMikdash. This chicken knew how to do it, and someone tricked the chicken into giving a secret away. The chicken went and committed suicide. What does it mean? It means that if you're unfaithful to yourself, life isn't life. You know, it says in Chumash that Moshe Rabbeinu says, "I called to bear witness against you, the heavens and earth." Jewish people, you're now making a covenant with Hashem. "I called to bear witness against you, the heavens and earth." The physical cosmic structure. So the question that the people want to know is, why did he call them for it? Well, what kind of witnesses are those? What's he calling on the inanimate parts of the universe to bear testimony? Why that? Give you another example before we come to the answer. There's an amazing Rashi that quotes a Gemara, quotes a Chazal that isn't in our, don't find it in our Talmud, but Rashi quotes it, that tells the following most amazing story. And you'll see it's no accident that this story is an illustration of love between a man and a woman, a relationship with them or not, faithfulness. That's why the Gemara tells it to you in that particular setting. Gemara says this. There was a young woman who fell into a pit, a bowl in Hebrew means like a pit, she couldn't get out, and her life was in danger. Somewhere out in the fields where no one was, and a young man happened to come past, and he heard this girl crying. He heard her crying out. The first thing, more things, he thought she wasn't human, it's another story, the mystical side is not right now. But anyway, at the end of the thing was, he went and he found this girl in the pit. So she said to him, "Please save me." So he said, "I'll save you if you marry me." So she said, "Fine." So he pulled her out of the pit. And then the Gemara says he wanted to marry her immediately on the spot. I'm not going to go into the details. She said to him, "That's not the Jewish way of doing things. Let me go home and get prepared. I'll go to my father's house in my town. I'll get prepared. You go home and get ready. And then you'll come and fetch me and we'll get married." So he said, "Fine. But how do I know that you'll be faithful?" So they made a covenant. And they said that our simon, our focus of this covenant will be this. And this chulda, the bow of a chulda. It was a chulda, which is a chulda is like a wildcat or a sort of a, some kind of rodent type of animal, like a weasel or a wildcat. Something getting out of short legs. There was one of these ferret-like or wild creatures that was over there, it was running past. That was all there was over there. There was a pit and a this little animal. So they said, by this pit and by this bow and this chulda, that will be our testimony. That will be our covenant. So she said, "Fine," she accepted it. So she went home to her town, and he went down to his town to get ready. What happened? He forgot. It's not the woman who forgets. It's not the woman who forgets that. It's the man who forgets. That's always the way. But that's not our thing. Anyway, I'm not saying women don't cook. Don't think. But anyway, that's what happened. So he went up. So what happened? He forgot. And the Gemara says he got married to somebody else in his place. And he had children. And a long time went on. When he had his first child, it fell into a pit and died. Into a bowl and died. He had a second child, and it was eaten by a chulda. So the Gemara says that his wife said to him, "What's going on?" She said to him, "If some strange thing had happened to one child, I wouldn't have said anything. But two bizarre things like this in the life of one couple, Is there something maybe you didn't tell me? Something, and he suddenly remembered that this was the sign of the covenant that was to remind him about his loyalty, and he told his wife the story. So she said to him, you divorce me right now, and you go back and find that girl. See this? He divorced his wife, and he went back to that town. He remembered the Kushi, the name of the town, and he went back to find that girl. When he arrived in town, many years later, he asked people for the name of that girl, and they said, you can't see her. He said, why not? And they said, because she's gone insane. He said, I want to see her anyway. And he was led into the place of a girl who was insane. When she saw him, and they were privately together, he gave her signs that they had shared between them, secret signs, and she revealed that she wasn't insane at all. She only pretended to be insane so that she wouldn't have to marry anybody else while she maintained her loyalty to him. For years and years and years. It was that they got married and they had children and they lived a normal life. Now, the question about all these things that we want to know is, what's the Gemara trying to tell you? Why are these illustrations of Emunah, why are they always based on something inanimate? Give an example of somebody who stood by his Emunah in times of trial, times of difficulty, whatever, heavens and earth. A chicken, a bull and a cougar, what? So before you say what it means is this. Because those are the things that don't change. There's nothing in the universe that ever breaks away from what it's supposed to be doing, except the human. There's not a cockroach in creation that ever does what it's not supposed to do. The remarkable thing? You won't find an atom ever that spins the way it shouldn't. Ever. Never. You won't find a star, a planet, nothing. There's nothing from the smallest creation of an atom to the most enormous system of cosmic structure that ever does what it's not supposed to do. There's only one thing in creation that ever does what it's not supposed to do, and that's you and me. It's a remarkable thing. Then you can rely on it. Look, if you want to learn Emunah, where do you go? You go into the inanimate world. You see how they do their job. You look at the tiniest cockroach and you'll see he always does what he's supposed to do. Never unfaithful to his job. Of course he can't be. He can't be unfaithful. He's created that way. But that's the place he's supposed to be. Only the human has the greatness to deviate from the path of loyalty. That only a human can do that. Only through free will, when you can deny not the higher self and go with the lower self, only the human has that ability to be able to deviate from what he's supposed to do. And that's why the examples that you find in Chazal are always examples taken from the world that never changes, that always lives up to its responsibility. Now, this is the beginning of the idea of Emunah. So, what we've learned, let's summarize. We've learned that the Jewish concept of Emunah is not anything to do with faithful belief. There is a blind element. There is certainly an element that you can never know exactly. And that's where the mistranslation into the blind faith explanation comes. And we'll have to work on that and understand, we need to think over the next few weeks, where is that area? What is blind about it? Where is the greatness of moving into a blind area? But you only move into an area of blindness when you have knowledge behind you. Right? What is the knowledge? I'll just give you an illustration and we'll finish with that. Again, we're only laying down an introduction. We're going to have to discuss in detail how you get the knowledge and then how you fix it. We're going to have to work out all these areas. But this is the overview that a person has to know. The example that we have is the founder of Yerusha, the founder of Torah, Avram Avin, Abraham. It says that Hashem said to him, go from your country, from your land, from your birthplace, from your father's house, go to the place that I'll show you. Ala'aret asher areka, to the land that I will show you. So the commentary says, why did Hashem say to him, the country that I will show you? Why didn't he tell him where? See, because that was an act of faith. He didn't tell him where until he got there. So his faith was that he moved out into the unknown. So the obvious question is, you know, if Hashem appeared to you one day and said to you, do me a favor, I'd like you to leave your birthplace, your father's house, your town, I'd like you to go to a certain place, you wouldn't go? Imagine if you're walking out of here tonight with an enormous hand taps you on the shoulder. And you turn around and you're standing face to face with the creator. I mean, assume you're not mentally unstable. That's easy. and you are told with absolute certainty that you've got a certain job you wouldn't do. Of course you do. Where's the faith? What do you mean faith? Where's your money? But it's not obvious thing. Of course you do. Why is Avraham Avinu regarded as a man of such intense faith? Because he believed and he did. He had a direct instruction from the creator himself. You hear the question? You hear the problem? The answer is this. You never do something without knowing that it's right. Otherwise you're foolish. To move out into some place because you think it may be correct in some vague way, it may be dangerous, it may not be. That doesn't make any sense. You don't function that way. Avraham Avinu moved out knowing that it was correct. He had the assurance of the creator of the world that was what to do. That's why you don't do that blindly. That you have to have a knowledge for. person bases his life on Torah, you have to examine it and see that it makes sense. You can't do it because it's another cult or another fad like somebody else out there who believes in some other thing, so you happen to be bamboozled into this one. You can be a goofy in Torah just like you can on anything else. And you can be a cultist and you can do that just as much in Torah. That's not the idea of Torah. The idea of Torah is that it makes sense to you, work it out, you see it operate, you see the connections, you feel it internally. You come to know that it's true. You have to start with that thing. But then you have to move into the unknown. That's not easy. Knowing that it's true doesn't make it. Imagine, put yourself in the following situation. Normal can taps you on the shoulder. I would like you to jump off this cliff. You look down and there's 5,000 feet of drop below you, there's jagged rocks on the bottom, and anybody who's ever jumped off there before rapidly becomes part of the scenery. But that's what I mean. This hand taps you on the shoulder, and I said, just you do me a favor, I would like you to jump off. So one second, what's going on here? You have the knowledge that you have the knowledge that it's right. No question about that, right? Couldn't have a better authority to get, doesn't make it easy. Takes enormous faith to have to do that. That's the Jewish confidence. It means that you move off with a certainty. You know what you're doing is correct. Otherwise, you're foolish to do it. But it doesn't mean that what you're going to is easy. That takes guts. And in Jewish terms, emunah means that you have to move off into the unknown area of the self. It means that you have to smash what you were before and move into an area that you've never discovered before. But before you can get there, you have to destroy what you are. Because if you try and get there while you're still safely what you are, you'll never get there. Because all you'll see is a new version, a new distorted version of what you actually, it's like you're sitting inside a prison, a glass prison, and they're shining the light onto you, right? And the light, you know, when the light shines through a prism, it breaks up into its colors. And you're trying to perceive the white light. While you're inside there, you'll never see it. No matter how you adjust yourself, you'll never see it. The only way is when you break out of here, then you'll see it. That's why Hashem didn't tell him where he was going until he got there. You can't see it while you're here. You can't see the next level of your development while you're still at this one. If you try and imagine what the next level is, so you'll only distort it to fit into the way you see things now. You with me? You first have to have the gap. First you have to know it's right. You don't leap off into unknown. Right? Into unknown factor that is correct to go with. You have to know that that's the next step. You have to know with certainty and surety. Well, once you know it's the next step, you have to move off into that area. You have to leave behind what you were before. That's very unsafe. That's very, very tough. That's what it means. It's a leap to the next level of growth, in spiritual terms, knowing that it's right, and yet not knowing what it is. That's what it means. That's what the sukkah is. When you move into a sukkah, and you do it spiritually, you do it correctly, you're not just sitting in a shack. You move out into sakha, into the root that means to perceive through things, to see where the root is. But then you move into that state that takes the tshuva, takes what you reached on Yom Kippur, takes that elevated level, takes that leap that you make to that level, and it consolidates, and it builds a protection around it, and it holds you at that level. And you draw down into the nefesh, you draw down into your own being the power of that spiritual level. And the way you do it is through sukkah. The way you do it is through happiness. That's why it's nonsense complex. The way you connect with any level, the way you connect with any new experience, right? What makes a marriage work is the happiness in it. If there's no happiness, I once heard a great man say that love that doesn't feel good isn't love. Love means giving, it means loyalty, but if it doesn't feel good, it's not love. It has to actually feel, and that's what, when you move out into a sukkah, it's a time of happiness. Because happiness is what connects the experience with the nishana. Okay, let's leave it for you.